Okay, thank you, Sean. So welcome everybody to the second session of our study. Last time we covered the first paragraph of chapter one of book two, part one, the chapter being Indeterminates, Cosmic Determinations, and the Indeterminable. Now, I know that there are a variety of versions being used. Some are using an online version, and some are using the latest edition, and some are using earlier editions. Today, I have actually a very old edition, one of the earliest editions, so I'm not going to be able to tell you what page we are on, but it's essentially we finished with reading the second paragraph last time, so we begin with reading the second paragraph this time. I kind of introduced this chapter last time, so I won't go into that lengthy introduction again. All I'd like to say to preamble our reading today is that in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo is addressing the problem of knowledge. And he's also laying down, in a sense, his methodology. How is he going to approach this problem of knowledge? And how is he going to connect it to the problem of being and becoming? So, as we know, the first part was really focused on that problem of being and becoming. More the problem of being. What is being? What is the ladder of existence all about? And there he ended by proposing that a conscious existence is the foundation of all things, unmanifest and manifest. And in this section, which is really foregrounding the issue of knowledge, is beginning with looking at this existence in an existential way. That is, how do we experience this existence and how do we come to knowledge? What does knowledge mean for us and how does it present itself? So in carrying that out, carrying out that inquiry, Sri Aurobindo begins, as I said last time, to engage with a number of different ways of looking at the problem of knowledge. One of them is the Vedantic way of looking at the problem of knowledge, which is
really... You're approaching the maximum allowed time for recording a message. If you wish to record further,
sorry about
please
that.
Choose the append option from the menu.
If you finish recording, just hang up.
Yeah, please, if you have your mics on or other devices on, please turn them off. And if you get off the line, I think, Sham, if you can just take people off if you see them getting
yes.
off the line.
Yes, I'll do that.
So what we have is a number of traditions that are being engaged. One is the Vedantic tradition, where we have a certain understanding of knowledge and ignorance. I will not get into those details, but we'll see that coming up gradually, and I introduced it last time. The second tradition that he brings up is the tradition of what is called natural philosophy. Natural philosophy is the older tradition of philosophy out of which science emerges. And we'll see that according to this, the question of what is material reality is backgrounded by bigger questions. A third tradition is, of course, the tradition of science, which is more narrowly focused on the question of material existence and the material cosmos, the cosmos in which we find ourselves. Now, the way Sri Aurobindo begins this is a kind of an empirical approach. That's why I compared, in a sense, the methodology of Gilles Deleuze, which is called transcendental empiricism, with Sri Aurobindo, though it is a different kind of transcendental empiricism. So Sri Aurobindo will begin in an empirical way by asking us to engage with our experience of the world, and then out of that we'll question it in terms of the different views that we can bring to it, and then propose a certain view, and then come back to look at the empirical situation once again. So the way in which he looks at it at first has to do with a few, kind of ground realities of our experience. One I introduced last time as what the philosopher Heidegger calls thrownness. In other words, we find ourselves thrown into a reality. It isn't something that we have accepted to come into, nor is it something which we were invited to enter. Okay, we just find ourselves in it. So that is our thrownness in this cosmos. And once we find ourselves in it, we need to make sense of it. And making sense of it is first and foremost a practical problem. We need to understand the medium in which we need to exist. So that is one. Then we also have a certain engagement with this particular reality, which to some extent goes beyond our functional and practical relationship with it, which is a pure relationship, a relationship of pure knowledge with it. We wish to know for knowing's sake, in other words. So these kinds of relationships emerge after the fact that we find ourselves thrown into this condition. So that is one ground reality of our empirical experience with the world in which we find ourselves. Another is this notion of something out of which we cannot withdraw ourselves entirely. We need to understand it, yet we are part of it. We are inextricably bound with it. And then we can ask the question as if we are only a part of it, trying to understand the whole of which we are a part, or can we emerge out of that? To what extent can we emerge out of that? So that becomes the second, reality, ground reality of our experience. The extent that we can withdraw out of that and objectify it, look at it as like a cosmos which is outside of ourselves, we find a situation in which it's as if we encountered something. If we are more materially minded, it would seem to be a machine. And if we are more animistically minded, it would seem to be a animal of some kind. We encounter some sort of a machine or an animal which, as it were, suddenly appeared out of the blue into our backyards. And we don't know from where it came. We don't know who sent it. We don't know what made those, whoever sent it, send it. What was the rationale behind this particular machine or animal? All we know is that it exists, and we start figuring out how it functions. It's as if we start taking apart the parts of this thing to figure out how it functions. And then we find that it isn't a static machine or animal. It's a dynamic one which is constantly changing. It's changing in front of our eyes, and we have to figure out in a predictable fashion what is going to happen because we are inextricably part of it. So these are the empirical sort of the nature of our experience with the reality in which we find ourselves. And we can answer the questions that arise in a number of ways. one of which is just, you know, after extracting ourselves, we brush aside all the questions having to do with the imponderables. Where did it come from? What does it mean? Those kind of questions. Why is it here? What are the laws out of which it emerges? We can sort of brush those aside and just say, well, let's restrict ourselves to understanding the practical questions of how this thing runs. And, you know, how are we connected with it? That is one approach. Another approach is that we accept that there are big questions and ponderables behind this, you know, existence in which we find ourselves, but those imponderables cannot be answered. So we can only have an attitude of wonder and a relationship of some kind of awe to those questions. That becomes the religious approach. The first one, I'd say, is the scientific approach. We brush those questions aside and we focus only on that which we find ourselves connected with. The second is the religious approach, in which we relate with awe and wonder to that which we find ourselves in, which is backgrounding the big questions that background our reality. The third way we can approach it is to try and enter into a relationship of knowledge to that which backgrounds what we experience, and try to intuit or understand what that is and see how those particular intuitions or understandings or faculties of knowledge play themselves out if we assume them, or how can we come to a grasp of them. So these are the various approaches that can be taken, and Sri Aurobindo takes us through some of these scenarios in these paragraphs that we are studying right now. So I think I'll stop there, and Shyam, you can draw on our participants to read from the second paragraph.
Sure. I'll ask.
Unless there are any comments or questions at this point, I think that it'll be better to take them, because we already had one session. So, if anybody wishes to make a comment or open something up, then we can consider it and move on.
Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning.
This is Frank. I just joined in 3 minutes ago.
Yeah, okay, Frank. If you want to say something, please do. Otherwise, keep your mic muted while you're on and not speaking, because that will make the experience a little quieter.
Oh, I haven't been speaking, but how do I get the mic on? So I typed a message, and now I have to go back to the other screen. I don't see how I'm on my phone. I don't know how to do that.
That's fine. I think at this point there is no echo from you, so just leave it as is for now.
Okay. Oh, I see. Here we go.
Thank you. So if there are no comments, the page number is on my book is 296. It's the second paragraph of the chapter Indeterminates, Cosmic Determinations and the Indeterminable. Just go by order. Olga, Christine, if you have the book, do you want to read the first paragraph, or rather the second?
Sure.
Yes, go for it. It starts with moreover the knowledge.
That foundation with the appearance.
We can't hear you. Are you muted? Hello?
Necessitate. There is a massive superstructure which has no.
Actually, could you start from the beginning? I don't think we heard any of this because there was no. Perhaps you are muted or something.
No, Olga, I think your connection is bad. So I think let's move on to somebody else.
Sure.
Olga, you know, I think we can't hear big chunks of what you're reading. So let's just back off and
sure.
ask somebody else to read.
Sure. Zakaria, do you want to start?
Sure. Can you hear me now?
Yes, you began.
Okay. Moreover, the knowledge gained is of phenomena, not of the reality of things or of the foundations of existence. Wherever our consciousness meets what seems to be a foundation, that foundation wears the appearance of a blank when it is not a void, an original state which is featureless and a multitude of consequences which are not inherent in the origin and which nothing in it seems to justify or visibly to necessitate. There is a mass of superstructure which has no clear and native relation to the fundamental existence. The first aspect of cosmic existence is an infinite which is to our perception an indeterminate, if not indeterminable. In this infinite, the universe itself, whether in its aspect of energy or its aspect of structure, appears as an indeterminate determination, a boundless finite, paradoxical but necessary expressions which would seem to indicate that we are face to face with a supra-rational mystery as the base of things. In that universe arise from where a vast number and variety of general and particular determinants which do not appear to be warranted by anything perceptible in the nature of the infinite, but seem to be imposed, or it may be self-imposed upon it. We give to the energy which produces them the name of nature, but the word conveys no meaning unless it is that the nature of things is what it is by virtue of a force which arranges them according to an inherent truth in them. But the nature of that truth itself, the reason why these determinants are what they are, is nowhere visible. It has been possible indeed for human science to detect the process or many processes of material things, but this knowledge does not throw any light on the major question. We do not know even the rationale of the original cosmic processes, for the results do not present themselves as their necessary, but only their pragmatic and actual consequence. In the end, we do not know how these determinants came into or out of the original indeterminate or indeterminable on which they stand forth as on a blank and flat background in the riddle of their ordered occurrence. At the origin of things, we are faced with an infinite containing a mass of unexplained finites, an indivisible full of endless divisions, an immutable teeming with mutations and differentiate. A cosmic paradox is the beginning of all things, a paradox without any key to its significance.
So, Sri Aurobindo begins, as we see, with the cosmos as we find it. The cosmos is the universe that we experience, that we find ourselves in. And in that itself is a certain kind of mystery. And as he says, that it's the phenomena that we can understand or we can gain knowledge of. But even as we gain knowledge of the phenomena, we know that there are realities that are unanswered. There are determinants that have their background in the indeterminable, something either indetermined or indeterminate. In other words, we have not been able to determine them, or we cannot determine them as they are, or the indeterminable that cannot be determined at all. And so this kind of relationship of phenomena to, I mean, in the older philosophies, they would be called noumena. Noumena are ideas, but we could actually call them what Sri Aurobindo calls them, which is real ideas, that are existence, which have a certain relationship with existence as we experience it, but that we don't have any access to. So that seems to be, on the one hand, something which, you know, is infinite, and then we are in an existence which itself seems to have no boundaries, but at the same time it is, you know, in a way bounded. So he uses that paradoxical term, the boundless finite. Boundless finite because there seems to be no end to it, but at the same time it seems to, you know, as even scientists say, have a kind of an envelope, that the universe has certain kinds of bounds, but at the same time it is boundless in that in its possibilities of expansion. You can't put a limit to it. So this kind of cosmic mystery is what he begins by looking at. And he looks at it to answer the question about what is at the back of all this. And he brings up first, the older idea of natural science. Then in natural philosophy, gains prominence in the 18th century or so. Actually, already in the 17th century, it arises out of what in Germany is called the post-Kantian tradition. And essentially, it is an attempt to displace the agency of God onto nature. In other words, there is a mystery, we used to call it God, religions would lay claim to that particular authority and tell us how we should deal with it. But now we don't believe in that anymore, but that has become displaced onto some kind of transcendental nature with a capital N. So nature becomes an agent which has intelligence. It's another way of saying today we have, for example, the Gaia hypothesis. The earth is a being. Or we can say the whole cosmos, of course, in natural philosophy, it's not just the earth, but the cosmos in terms of its vital forces, its mental forces, all this is considered nature. So nature is a being that is expressing itself, and we are part of its expression. So that kind of natural philosophy is what he's drawing on over here when he talks about we can give it the name nature. Okay, so he also draws our attention to the two ways of looking at this. Either we can look at it structurally, that is, we study the entire cosmos in terms of the relationships of the various entities in it, or we can look at it as a process, as an energy, as he says. So that we are just looking at the dynamics. It's the statics and the dynamics of existence. So in both cases, we really are faced with the same mystery. Ultimately, both of them backgrounded by mystery, and then we can, as he says, look at it from the viewpoint of a nature. So he says, we give to the energy which produces them the name of nature. But the word conveys no meaning unless it is that the nature of things is what it is by virtue of a force which arranges them according to an inherent truth in them. So nature, if we are going to give any agency to nature, if we are going to say nature is a being, then we have to look at it as a, not as some kind of, you know, person, but as some kind of an intelligent force, a force which has a certain pattern to it, a certain kind of intelligence which it is expressing. But we can't go any further. To say that also leaves enormous mysteries behind it. What is that force? Where did that intelligence come from? Why is it there? And is it at all there? So this notion of nature has been severely criticized, and that's one part of the reason why today science has split off from what was called natural philosophy and stands as a different discipline of knowledge by itself. Because it doesn't want to assume that there is an intelligence of any kind in nature. On the other hand, as he'll point out, that you cannot entirely explain it through chance. So what scientists do is if they look at the dynamics of things, they explain it in terms of chance and necessity. In other words, there are accidental events that happen, and then these events take on a certain kind of reality that carries inherent forces that forces them to act in a certain way. So it's the combination, but then the background of it is chance. So from out of this natural philosophy way of looking at it, he will then move, say that even that is inadequate, and then he will move to human science. It has been possible indeed for human science to detect the process or many processes of material things. But this knowledge does not throw any light on the major question. We do not know even the rationale of the original cosmic processes, for the results do not present themselves as their necessary, but only their pragmatic or actual consequence. In other words, if we posit this kind of occurrence of chance, even that leaves some questions prior to, you know, when did it all begin? How did it begin? And particularly, it leaves the why question completely out of the picture. Chance produced certain things, but the things they produced had certain kinds of properties. And those properties, as you bring out in the next paragraphs, have a certain kind of rationale. And are we to look for that rationale in anything prior to their existence, or just assume that they are, you know, willy-nilly there? If we make the second assumption, it's just an assumption. It's just an assumption assumed because we want to hide certain questions. So that becomes the way Sri Aurobindo is presenting it, and it's not really necessary but pragmatic and actual consequences and processes that are phenomenal that science explains. So these determinants exist, but what is behind it, as he ends this paragraph, is the origin of things, where there is an infinite containing a mass of unexplained finites, an indivisible full of endless divisions, and immutable teeming with mutations and differentiate. The other really important, philosophical ground reality of existence that he's bringing out through this is that if we are to assume that there is some kind of conscious being, it doesn't really present itself to our knowledge of our existence. This is a very important point, that the cosmos does not carry evidence of it and leaves the whole thing in a mystery. It's wrapped up in a mystery. This notion is going to be the foundation of the division between vidya and avidya. In other words, if there is conscious being, we cannot say there isn't, nor can we say there is. That's where the mystery occurs. And it is so because whatever we find ourselves in, the cosmic experience, is one in which if there is a conscious being, it has absented itself. So that we cannot assert its reality.
Is it okay to ask a question now?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a question, but I find it very interesting. He talks about a cosmic paradox as the beginning of all things. Well, paradox, isn't it the language of the Vedas?
Yeah, Vince. In fact, it's more properly the language of the Upanishads.
Upanishads, yes.
Yeah, the Vedic language, more a symbolic language. It's the language, but you could also say that there is a paradoxical component to the Vedas. But certainly, it's the language of the Upanishads. And yeah, cosmic paradox is partly because, as I said, if we talk about existence as something in which, there seems to be a hidden meaning. If that seeming hidden meaning was not there at all, then it wouldn't be a paradox. There would be no puzzle to it. It would be either on this side or that of knowledge or of knowledge, actually. It would be either the knowledge of conscious being or the knowledge of world without any meaning to it.
See? Right.
But yeah, so even, say, where I was talking earlier of Deleuze, they have to contend with the fact, even if they don't assume the reality of conscious existence, they have to contend with the fact that there is order in the universe, that the universe is understandable, which is why science goes after the laws of the universe at all. That's a big mystery. I mean, why is it that there is order to the universe? And then, the fact that in a certain sense, there is a kind of, like he will also point out, there is a law of regularity and variation. It's as if there are certain things which continually present themselves, but continually vary themselves as well. This actually becomes the basis of Deleuze's book, Difference and Repetition. So we cannot get away from this paradox that there seems to be something which is repeating itself, something which is ordered, something which is intelligent, but which doesn't present itself, and which seems to hide itself in its opposite.
Right, and I just find it very interesting that you get a little hint of that in paradox. In paradox, in the Upanishads, this to me is so a wonderful way of experiencing, I don't know if you can say that, or just bringing out the, mysteries of existence. I find that through reading those, I get that sense that you talked about of awe and wonder, that, as you said, is the religious experience. But I also don't like the word religious too much. But
yeah, no, sure. I mean, if you exclusively have that kind of experience, then it can be the pure religious experience, the religious nevertheless, you are quite right that that kind of awe is not only the religious experience, it's also the experience of the philosopher. Heidegger makes it the basis of his ontology. He says that the big mistake of both science and philosophy is to be focused too much on the world. Rather, our focus should be on this ground, which is a mystery. And if we keep our, even if we don't know it, if we keep our attention on it, then we are in relation with that ground.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to say it.
Devajita, so he says about how the goal, the aim, or rather the it has been to detect the process rather than not throw any light on the major question, which is the why of it. What is your intuition about, you know, whether the cause and the why of it can be found from within the phenomenon itself? Like, will the universe itself contain the cause of it, or should the cause be always looked outside of it?
No, actually, as you will point out, that it is at both, you know, I mean, Sri Aurobindo will go to a kind of a position which today, you know, philosophically speaking, is called panentheism. Panentheism basically means that there is a conscious reality that is too great to be contained within anything, and at the same time that has entered into the cosmos. So it's both transcendent and immanent. So we can look for it inside the phenomena itself, but then we have to ask the right kinds of questions, and we have to also recognize the fact that it escapes. That's the reason why we have the indeterminates and cosmic determinations, because there is the Vedantic idea of the known, the unknown, and the unknowable.
Somebody needs to mute the microphone.
Yeah, Frank, please mute your microphone.
Yes, I'm having a... I don't know how to get to the screen where the microphone function is on the screen. I've tried 10 times. How do I do that? So I can mute? I'm on my cell phone.
We don't know offhand, but as of now, it seems quite enough. I'll tell you separately. We don't know offhand how to do that.
I understand. Okay. Yes, yeah, sorry. I tried to mute. I'll continue trying to mute it.
Sure.
I apologize. Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. It's so long as it's quiet, it's fine. But if you're going to have other conversations, it's going to impact the. There's about 20 people over here, so please make sure that you know, either it's muted or you turn it off and you have other conversations.
Oh, so I can turn it off and then come back because I have to be at the mechanic.
Yeah.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
Yes, Devishna.
Yes, one can look for it, but one has to ask the right questions and develop the right intuition. So, yes and no. In other words, it can be approached within the phenomena, but at the same time, there is a part of it that remains outside the phenomena.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Keka here.
Yes.
When you speak of this natural philosophy, has anyone, saw it this way or tried to see it this way? I mean, I'm trying to think of any other perspective which has ever been explored that, this one, and I mean, all the things that we are speaking of is as if centralized, as if something that has a centralized control, whichever way, conscious way or ignorant way. Now, has there been at all any effort to explain it in a distributed fashion, meaning it could be totally an aggregation And because, you know, it could be also by the mind, which tries to link things together and tries to make some sense out of it. So what if things are actually not centralized? And, you know, it's just, I'm just saying that if anybody or, I mean, not that I believe in it, but if any kind of effort has been there, decentralized.
Actually these positions have been explored, all these various positions have been explored. For example, you see, when the whole thing about the idea of nature actually spawns off the, in modern times it spawns off what is called romanticism, which, you know, becomes very big both in Germany as well as in England, with the romantic poets, for example, who are talking about intelligence in nature that is manifesting itself. But at the same time, there are variations of that that are putting, I mean, what is called pantheism, you know, includes the notion of some kind of a distributed spirit. In other words, the spirit is not centralized, but the spirit is, there are spirits or aspects of that spirit in all things. And those things are in relationship with each other, and they are forming a relational world. There is also, of course, in Buddhism, the notion of codependent arising. In other words, these entities are together only because they are dependent on each other. So that the whole thing is a kind of a sort of a mutuality, but there's nothing underneath it. These ideas have also been kind of explored. So older animistic ideas were also like that, but they didn't believe that there was one reality behind the many spirits. Everything was kind of an entity that through relationship gives coherence to the whole. So there is that, and there is also, of course, if we look at Vedanta, and what Sri Aurobindo is saying is actually not very far from that as an aspect of the reality. In other words, that is the nature of avidya. Avidya is a self-presentation of the vidya, in which it withdraws its central control, and it allows plurality to manifest itself with a hidden intelligence underneath it.
Thank you. So basically this mutuality and this pluralism that can sort of give the hint of a creation, right? Like what I mean is that if we think of a presumed or a predetermined order, and we are just seeking it as if the order is already there and we are seeking it where it is. Instead of that, I mean, if it is that order is something that is perpetually being created, and all the different spirits are actually contributing in their own way to... what I'm probably trying to point at is the becoming as the leader.
Absolutely.
To sort of prepare or create beings.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. So in a way, even Sri Aurobindo is going to say that, and that's the reason why this difference between vidya and avidya is so important. It's important because that freedom is given to plurality. It's as if now the whole thing about the mystery being if we are talking about conscious being is not only one, but it is also infinite. And so the one and the infinite, if we look at it in finite terms, we can't grapple with these two realities at the same time. One becomes an instance in the realm of finites. While in the realm of infinites, one is the only thing there is, which is infinite. So if we look at a reality in which the one has withdrawn itself and filled itself out as its own infinity, then basically we have a creation in which we have infinite realities that are trying to build some order out of their plurality. So that is this is the nature of avidya. So vidya and avidya splits on that very ground. And Sri Aurobindo that's part of the background of this entire chapter. He's trying to say that that is our ground reality. We have to accept that as our ground reality. What seems to be the one is nowhere evident over here. And it's not only not evident because it is hidden, but because it has, by some deliberate force, by its own self-choice, withdrawn itself and allowed its own immanence. In other words, it is itself becoming one. So it's the becoming rather than the being. So yeah, there are a number of philosophies that will sort of split off in that direction. And then they will split off, but very few of them will unite the two. You see that there is a relationship between being and becoming. That becomes a big problem in many of these philosophies. Of course, a lot of them are trying to engage these two and coming up with various kinds of answers.
Devashish?
Yes, Vince.
Can you say that, like, Sri Aurobindo is the latest in a line of Vedantic philosophers?
Yeah, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly, you could call him the latest in a line of Vedantic philosophers.
Yeah, so he explains in more depth or whatever, at greater length, the distinction between Vija and Avija. And ignorance, yeah.
And you see, the thing is that he's coming, when you say he's the latest of the Vedantic philosophers, he's coming at the long end of a period in which modernity has intervened and a large number of other philosophies have also intervened. And he's responding to those as well. So that's the reason why you could say that it's a kind of a hybrid Vedantism, that it is a Vedantism that at the same time is addressing a number of the other philosophical approaches that have emerged.
And how do you think, somehow what comes to mind is the multiverse theory. Is that the, I don't know, I've been reading about multiverses and wondering where Sri Aurobindo will explain them, but then when I read the sentence, at the origin of things we are faced with an infinite containing a mass of unexplained finites, that's probably, he talks about there implicitly, yeah.
Yeah, but I think that can certainly be read into it. But I think he's more concerned to begin with our own empirical experience of this universe. And he's saying that the mystery already exists over here, and then behind it is a greater mystery. So within the cosmos, there is a mystery. Behind the cosmos, there is a mystery.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of amazing.
I mean, I'm just trying to think in that sort of detour approach, that is the same being, right, which is in the division, as well as the one which is behind the division. There is no, I mean, it's the same substance, right?
Yes.
So yeah, so same intelligence, same idea is in both.
Hello.
Yes. Hello, Francesca. You are on. So we are conducting the group right now, and you know, I think Shyam can tell you what page number we are on.
That's wonderful. Okay, let me grab the. I'm going to grab the text. One moment.
Yes, Tita, can I answer your question? I wanted to say that. Okay, wait. Francesca, can you?
Yeah, is that Frank? Does it help?
I'm here. I'm just looking for the.
Sure, I'll tell you the page number. That's fine. We are on page 296. Please mute your microphone since Devaj is there speaking to the group right now. Go ahead, Devashita.
Yeah, I was actually going to say that philosophies of excuse me, can you repeat your question, because I think there's a lot of things going on. If you repeat your question once, I'll be able to answer it.
Yeah, I mean, what I meant was that just as a continuation of the previous thing that I was saying is that pluralism, if we could add, I mean, if it is possible to address from the fact that it's the same substance that is behind, that is in that one which is behind all, the same substance is in all divisions as well.
Yeah.
And as a whole, not as a part.
Yeah. The major philosopher who does that is Spinoza. Spinoza is the one who actually resolves the problem in that way by saying that there is only one substance, that there is, it's a kind of a monism, that there is only one substance, but it presents itself or expresses itself differently. And Deleuze, when he talks, he draws both on Spinoza and on Nietzsche, and he explains our experience of time in terms of the eternal recurrence of the never same. Okay, it's the one being who's never the same, because he's always, its infinity is being expressed at all times.
Right. Thank you. Maybe that's how we can define time also, right? We can define time by change.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I have a problem with the concept of monism, because how do you include the notion of the difference within monism? That's why when I think of ontology, I kind of think of a pluralistic monism or a monistic pluralism. How do you feel about that? Like, how do you include difference within a monistic ontology?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what you could call it a pluralistic monism, which is what Deleuze is doing. He's talking of the eternal recurrence of the never same. Okay, in other words, it is, and or he defines his philosophy as monism is equal to pluralism. So you see, and that's what Spinoza is doing as well. He's saying that I think I agree with you, Francesca, in the sense, and Sri Aurobindo will too, because in a way to say that is to undercut the fact that there is a distinction between vidya and avidya. In other words, then there is a kind of somewhere where there is a chasm between the one and the many in our experience. So if we have to recognize that, as well as recognize the fact that the one is becoming and speaking of what he calls university, right? University, in other words, the radical plurality of the one, the radical infinity of Brahman. So that notion is something which also has within it another particular kind of a dichotomy, the dichotomy of the only thing there is experienced as itself and the many without the experience of the one, the radical plurality without the experience of the one. That those two forms of experience split vidya from avidya in the Vedantic tradition. And of course, there is a point where one can bring them together, but it isn't a point that we have reached. That's why becoming is something which is striving towards a point that is not yet there in experience. You see? So certain traditions will say, let's resolve that by getting out of this pluralistic world and experiencing the one. But they've lost the pluralism, they've lost the world, they've lost the becoming. They've entered into pure being. But on the other hand, those who are invested in the becoming, they will talk about a perpetual becoming of pluralism, which in a sense has to accept the fact that there is pluralism which has not attained monism. So, and we are in that condition. We are in that condition. So we have to accept that fact. But at the same time, what he's saying is that beyond that experience is an experience in which it is the radical infinity of the one that is being expressed at each moment. It's because we experience things in a finite way that we haven't been able to experience that.
Yeah, that was a great way to explain. Thank you so much. Yeah, that was wonderful. And one more question. So within the concept of Brahman, is how the notion of becoming goes with Brahman?
Yeah, the notion of becoming goes with Brahman, Francesca, in the sense that... So Brahman, you can either look at it statically as the only thing there is, which is eternal, immutable, and static, or you can look at it temporally, in which case it is the in a process of continuous self-exploration. If it is something which is radically infinite, then it is in a process of continuous self-exploration, which without end, and that is a becoming. So these categories of space and time through which we look at Brahman are already derivative categories. They are categories that either belong to, that belong to mind. They may not belong to human mind, but they certainly belong to a certain mental determination. So to look at it statically as the immutable that never changes, the being without becoming, is also a conditioned way of looking at it. It is both a becoming and a being.
Oh, it's wonderful. Oh, wow. That's wonderful, because I heard usually that it's more like being without the becoming, but it's really good, like the way you said, it's both. It's not only being, it's also becoming. That's...
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah, can I ask you, only which chapter is that? Because I have another edition and it's through chapters. Can you tell me which chapters are you reading?
The chapter is, this is book 2, part 1. The name of the chapter is Indeterminates, Cosmic Determinations and the Indeterminable. And we have just finished the second paragraph on that book, which starts with, moreover, on the chapter, which starts with, moreover, the knowledge.
Yeah. Okay, can we move on to the next paragraph?
Margaret, would you like to read?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. It is possible indeed to question the need of possessing an infinite which contains our formed universe. Although this conception is imperatively demanded by our mind as a necessary basis to its conceptions. For it is unable to fix or assign a limit, whether in space or time or essential existence, beyond which there is nothing, or before or after which there is nothing. Although, too, the alternative is a void or nihil, which can be only an abyss of the infinite, into which we refuse to look. An infinite mystic zero of non-existence would replace an infinite X as a necessary postulate, a basis for our seeing of all that is to us existence. But even if we refuse to recognize anything as real, except the limitless expanding finite of the material universe and its teeming determinations, the enigma remains the same. Infinite existence, infinite non-being, or boundless finite, all are to us original indeterminates or indeterminables. We can assign to them no distinct characters or features, nothing which would predetermine their determinations. To describe the fundamental character of the universe.
Margaret,
yes?
We lost you for a little bit.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
So let me say, I'll go back to infinite existence.
Sure.
Infinite existence, infinite non-being, or boundless finite, all are to us original indeterminates or indeterminables. We can assign to them no distinct characters or features, nothing which would be predetermined their determinations. To describe the fundamental character of the universe as space or time, or space-time, does not help us. For even if these are not abstractions of our intelligence, which we impose by our mental view on the cosmos, the mind's necessary perspective of its picture, these two are indeterminates and carry in themselves no clue to the origin of the determinations that take place in them. There is still no explanation of the strange process by which things are determined, or of their powers, qualities, and properties. No revelation of their true nature, origin, and significance.
So here, it's this short paragraph. Essentially, he is drawing on the two kinds of infinities that may background this existence. We can either call it an infinite. We can say that it comes out of a void. But even if we say it has come out of a void, he's saying that's only a way of saying that it has come out of an infinite abyss, a certain kind of a an indeterminable. And in either case, whether it is a positive infinity or a negative infinity, it remains an indeterminable. This is basically the point he's talking about. And then, as we discussed just in the discussion before, even to talk about space and time, or even to conflate the two in a space-time, is already a determination of something which is indeterminable. we can look at it in as we were discussing, we can look at Brahman as spatially explained or described through something which is static, or we can look at it as something which becomes forever. Either case, we are actually sticking a determinable onto something which is beyond that, which is indeterminable. So that there is something which is presenting itself through certain categories, but there are questions behind it which are not addressed or cannot be understood through those questions, through those categories. So I think basically this paragraph is highlighting the infinite nature of the background.
Well, I have a question about what is defined by like the concept of mind. Like, how do you define the mind, and is that like separated from the body? Like, what does it mean by the concept of mind? I always have a problem with that, because kind of going to the dualistic, you know, Cartesian frame, mind body, which I don't believe necessarily so much into. So I was just wondering, what do you think he refers to by a notion of mind? Is it an embodied mind, or is it like more of an abstract mind?
No, here, actually, he does say our mental view of the cosmos. He's talking by mind, of course. I mean, he's not making a distinction between embodied mind and disembodied mind. He's talking about human experience as a mental experience, the form of mentality with which we understand the universe is what he's talking about. He's not making a distinction between mind as a property of body or whatever. I mean, so you can talk about an animism in which there is a life experience that has a certain kind of a latency of mind. The animal mind, for example, has a different experience with time than the human mind. You could say both of them are sort of forms of matter for all he cares. Because, from a certain point of view, all these, you know, specializations of consciousness have different modalities. He's not making a kind of a distinction about that. He's just talking about the fact that the human experience that can express itself in mental categories, that is of a certain... See, animal will not be able to write down what its experience of time is or what its experience of space is in the same way that the human can. Mm-hmm. The animal will not be able to sort of imagine the origin of the cosmos in the same way the human can. It's an expression of mind, which is a specific expression of mind. You can say the human mind. It doesn't say anything about whether it is embodied or disembodied. Mm-hmm. It's just talking about it as a form of expression.
Mm. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
So in the Vedantic tradition, Francesca, just to elaborate a little bit, because I know where you're coming from, with regard to the mind-body split. In the Vedantic tradition, it's much more Spinozan in that sense. There is only Brahman, and everything is a kind of a modality of Brahman. So matter is basically Brahman presenting itself in a certain way, and in that way everything else is also contained. So in other words, matter contains in it life, mind, supermind, everything. Life contains everything in it too. But you may think of these, I think Deleuze uses the word fold. In other words, each of these is a kind of a self-presentation in which certain properties have been foregrounded and the other properties have been withheld or made latent. They also exist, but they are made latent. So that's the way. And then there are variations within that, a spectrum of variations within that. So that's the kind of ontology that is being dealt with here.
And so in that case, what would be the difference between matter and energy?
In a way, there is no difference. The difference would be, again, talking about matter and energy would be talking about these two things in terms of space and time, again. Mm-hmm. Energy is process. When we look at process, we talk about it as energy. Mm-hmm. When we look at structure, we talk about it as matter.
Mm-hmm. And every energy is consciousness, or consciousness is something that can develop, like, consciousness also is everywhere, or not necessarily?
It is everywhere. Everything is conscious, but again, consciousness is modulating itself in different degrees. So that's the whole thing that this chapter is talking about, is that we seem to find ourselves in a world where there is no consciousness, and consciousness is emerging out of inconscience. But as a matter of fact, that is an appearance. See, that's our experience, has that appearance to it.
Wow, that's so much to say. Thank you so much. That's sure. Yeah, that's so interesting. Wow. Yeah.
Any other questions, comments on this paragraph? Or shall we move on to one more?
Yes, this is John Robert. I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
I'm just trying to put into context that makes sense to me of what Sherbino is doing here.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to suggest two things and ask you to comment on them. One thing is what he's doing is he's bringing forward this background, which to the modern mind is not, we don't put our attention on it. We have more of a secular or a materialistic consciousness, at least in the West.
Yeah.
And so he's bringing this forward so that we can look at it and see, oh, science is maybe not talking about this, but still it's there, and the mind, if it's going to look at the whole of our experience, is going to need to deal with it. You need to deal with the background. And then it also seems like what he's doing is kind of setting up the issue that he's going to solve by going beyond mind to supermind.
Yeah, you're quite right. You're absolutely right. I mean, at this point, and I think that's where the notion of mind is coming in, because in a way, knowledge is going to be something which is not only of the mind. There is knowledge of all kinds. There is knowledge. The mind has a certain understanding, which is its knowledge, but we have knowledge of the body, we have knowledge of our emotions, we have knowledge which is beyond the mind. And here, Sri Aurobindo, that's why I said he's engaging a number of traditions. He's engaging the Vedantic tradition, he's engaging the scientific tradition, he's engaging the philosophical post-Kantian tradition. And as a result, he's looking at the problem of knowledge from the viewpoint of mental conceptions. And there you're absolutely right, he's drawing our attention to the background, and that essential background from which emergence of the empirical occurs. And he is going to essentially, after drawing our attention to it, he's going to posit certain kinds of relationships between that and the experienced.
Thank you.
Shall we move on to the next paragraph, Sean?
Sure. John Robert, would you like to read next?
Yes.
Okay, so we're starting with actually to our science?
Yes.
Yes.
Actually, to our science, its infinite or indeterminate existence reveals itself as an energy, known not by itself, but by its works, which throws up in its motion waves of energism, and in them a multitude of infinitesimals. These, grouping themselves to form larger infinitesimals, become a basis for all the creations of the energy, even those farthest away from the material basis, for the emergence of a world of organized matter, for the emergence of life, for the emergence of consciousness, for all the still unexplained activities of evolutionary nature. On the original process are erected a multitude of processes which we can observe, follow, and take advantage of many of them, utilize. But they are none of them fundamentally explicable. We know now that different groupings and a varying number of electric infinitesimals can produce or serve as a constituent occasion, miscalled the cause, for here there seems to be only a necessary antecedent condition, for the appearance of larger atomic infinitesimals of different natures, qualities, powers. But we fail to discover how these different dispositions can come to constitute these different atoms. How the differentiate in the constituent occasion or cause necessitate the differentiate in the constituent in the constituted outcome or result. We know also that certain combinations of certain indivisible atomic infinitesimals produce or occasion new invisible determinations quite different in nature, quality, and power from the constituent infinitesimals. But we fail to discover, for instance, how a fixed formula for the combination of oxygen and hydrogen comes to determine the appearance of water, which is evidently something more than a combination of gases, a new creation, a new form of substance, a material manifestation of a quite new character. We see that a seed develops into a tree. We follow the line of the process of production and we utilize it. But we do not discover how a tree can go out of a seed, how the life and form of a tree come to be implied in the substance or energy of the seed, or if that be rather the fact, how the seed can develop into a tree. We know that genes and chromosomes are the cause of hereditary transmissions, not only of physical, but of psychological variations, but we do not discover how psychological characteristics can be contained and transmitted in this inconscient material vehicle. We do not see or know, but it is expounded to us as a cogent account of nature processes, that a play of electrons, of atoms and their resultant molecules, of cells, glands, chemical secretions, and physiological processes, manages by their activity on the nerves and brain of a Shakespeare or a Plato to produce, or could be perhaps the dynamic occasion for the production of a Hamlet, or a symposium, or a republic. But we fail to discover or appreciate how such material movements could have composed or necessitated the composition of these highest points of thought and literature. The divergence here of the determinants and the determination becomes so wide that we are no longer able to follow the process, much less understand or utilize. These formulae of science may be pragmatically correct and infallible. They may govern the practical how of nature's processes, but they do not disclose the intrinsic how or why. Rather, they have the air of the formulae of a cosmic magician, precise, irresistible, automatically successful, each in its field, but their rationale is fundamentally unintelligible.
So he's expanding on the same point that he started with, and here he is highlighting the problem of kind and degree, and of what we call the emergence of holistic properties. There is a difference in kind that occurs from one level to another of constitution. In other words, you put certain things together, what emerges on the other side is a difference in kind, not just a difference in degree. You cannot, by the properties of the constituents, predict the properties of the constitution, of the constituted. This is something we kind of, again, these are questions that are uncomfortable, but we think that they don't really need to be asked. It's almost as if it's a kind of an absurd question. It looks like questions that have been outlawed by the processes or the kind of the epistemology of science. It's enough to recognize the fact that when certain constituents are put together, they emerge with new properties. Okay, but the how question as to where did those properties come from is an uncomfortable one that is not addressed, but which points again to exactly what he's talking about, that there are indeterminables or indeterminates to even the cosmic process itself. So even within the phenomena, there are these indeterminates that point to a mystery or some kind of a paradox. We can talk about processes in an overt manner, but there is a kind of intrinsic why, as he says, or even the how question is not fully answered.
Well, in that case, how goes it with predetermination? Like, is there some kind of predetermined lines between the kind and the degree? Like, is that something that he talks about, especially if we think about the eternal recurrence?
No, he's saying that there is something, but if we look at it from the viewpoint of our experience and our way of asking questions and answering them, there seems to be a mystery. In other words, there is something we are not addressing. There's something we have not yet taken account of. This is exactly, in a way, a transcendental empiricism, where the empirical cannot fully be explained without arriving at some kind of a transcendental reality, which then can inform our understanding of the empirical and release new properties. So, for example, if you look at Deleuze, where he's saying the difference between the molar and the molecular, and what he's talking about, the difference between the arboreal and the rhizomatic. In other words, there is a point, if we assume the arboreal, then we are not being able to explain certain emergences. But if we go behind, we can find something that is not yet addressed, which can explain these properties. So that's what he's saying, that there are certain types of emergences that need other questions and other understandings to explain.
So there is no form of predetermination in this picture, correct? Or yes?
Explain again what you mean by predetermination in this case, Francesca.
Yeah, well, for instance, if we think about the seed and the tree, on some level, the tree is predetermined by the seed. On some level, it's already like, but you know, but then the way the tree form, it's a process, and in the process of predetermination is processed as well. So it's not a complete predetermination in the sense that, for instance, we think about eternal recurrence, instead of thinking of a circle, it would be more of a spiral. So there are things that are going to come back, but not necessarily in exactly the same way. It would be like, think about DNA. It's still evolving, constituting the being is in a process, and for instance, environment is already affecting the DNA. So just thinking in this picture, you know, like, because he doesn't talk about predetermination, but when you think about the seed and the tree, the tree on some level is predetermined by the seed and vice versa. So I was, just a thought that came to my mind, but...
Yeah, that is true. And I mean, all these kind of things, but he's talking about properties here. It is predetermined in process, but he's asking the why question. Why is it that the tree, say, because the tree, if you look at it from a slightly different point of view, the tree and the seed and the relationship between the two, you can talk about it as a predetermination. In other words, the laws are already contained within the process. But still, you have to look at the properties that are totally different, and the difference in properties points to different symbolical realities that have been brought together. Say, in an earlier natural philosophy, there was the theory of correspondences, or the theory of sympathetic magic. So those kind of ideas bring about certain different notions of the meanings of things. Why does a thing have a certain kind of, certain types of properties, but something else have other kinds of properties? So those questions are not addressed just by talking about predetermination of process that makes a certain thing take on a certain appearance.
Does the Higgs boson enter into this?
That I don't know. Vince, I don't think so. Okay. But I don't know.
And just to add a little bit to the discussion, so if we go, for instance, to the material level, matter has a genealogy. Like, matter doesn't come from out of nothing. It's like, it's let's say there is it has a history. Like each like, I was just thinking if like this mystery of forms that come from where they come, do they come from the history of the material object, or of the energy, or if maybe you can, maybe we can add the concept of karma, like kind of, is it a mystery, or it's kind of related to kind of a material, material consequences, or how would you call it? Like, nothing come out of nothing, like nothing is destroyed, nothing is renewed, like everything is in a process. So since everything is a process, everything come with a history or a history, like it's, I just wonder if, like, some of these forms are consequences of what comes already with the seed, for instance, you know, or I don't know if I'm explaining myself. Is it something that is just a fresh and a new, is a mystery, or is not completely a mystery? Like, it comes from the history of the same material object, or from the history of that energy, or in Indian term would be maybe the karma. You know what I mean? Like, is that something that can enter the discussion, or...
Francesca, so actually, say, for example, karma, I think it's something slightly different, because karma is presupposing a certain type of, there is a history there. Karma is presupposing a process. But here, one may say, like, if you talk about the seed and the tree as properties and that are related to each other, not only genealogically, but also in terms of symbolically, then we may be able to say that they are coexisting realities. They are not necessarily historical realities, but coexisting realities. That everything coexists. in a certain way as an expression.
Mm. Yeah. So.
See, like they say, that's why they have the old paradox, which is the what they call the chicken and egg paradox, you know, which came first. So they both came first. You see, that's the whole thing. I mean, you can't think about one without the other. It isn't that one, and you could say that, so there is a primordial historicity to it. There's a primordial, always deferred primordial historicity to it. So that itself is pointing to the fact that there is a realm of symbols, if you want to call it that, which can be part of, it's all one. I mean, whether you look at it as realm of symbols that are imprinted within matter, these are idea forces, if you want to call it that. Ideas not in some kind of way split off from matter, but immanent ideas.
Thanks. Yeah.
Devesh is there?
Yeah.
It's actually getting just a little past 9:30.
Sure.
So do we want to wrap up for today, say a few words, and continue in the next class, which will be 2 weeks from now?
Yeah. Sure. I think to wrap up, essentially, I think we still, Sri Aurobindo, is expanding on the idea of the determinate, the indeterminate, and the indeterminable. And I think John Roberts was quite succinct in saying that he's drawing our attention to these indeterminate and indeterminable, the penumbra and the infinite beyond it, so as to kind of create the condition out of which he can, you know, it's really, as one may call it, a panentheism that he's going to propose, which presents something which is both immanent and transcendent, that there is something which is completely plural and intrinsic within this becoming, and something which has become that becoming and is sort of expressing through it. But that will come later. That's part of the argument that he's trying to develop. At this point, he's drawing our attention to the indeterminates and the indeterminables behind the determined universe.
Thank you, Devashishida. So I'll close out at this point, and we'll continue the next class in 2 weeks' time, same time on Saturday.
Thank you.
So the date is going to be
26th.
For the next class, the date is going to be 26th of July.
Sure. So 26th of July, Saturday at 8 o'clock California time. I'll start the call then.
Okay.
Thank you,
Devashita.
Thank you
so much. Thank you. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having these classes again. It's great.
Yeah. Thank you.